Lecture 8, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, September 29th, 2006.
All right, let's get started. Last time we were looking at the finite potential well, and we considered first the bound states, and we found that in solving that problem for bound states, we had to solve ultimately a transcendental equation, which I solved for you graphically. From the graphical solution, we could see that no matter how shallow that well is, there will still be at least one bound state. Furthermore, as the well depth increases, eventually the problem will reduce to the infinite potential well, which makes sense. In the limit of a very deep well, it should act like an infinite potential well. And that's what we saw. The number of states would increase, and their energies would approach that of the infinite square well potential. What we're going to do today is quickly talk about the scattering states and then move on to the three-dimensional Schrodinger equation. So let's talk about scattering states for the finite potential well. Of course, the scattering states are going to be those for which the energy is greater than zero. And there's three regions in space we need to worry about. The first is for x less than minus a. In this region, of course, the potential is zero. And so we know what the solution to the Schrodinger equation is. We're not even going to write it down anymore. We'll just write down the result. It'll have the form of a e to the ikx plus b e to the minus ikx, where k, of course, is square root 2me over h bar, as we've now seen for several potentials in this class. Furthermore, we know what the meaning, physical meaning of these states are. It's a rightward and leftward propagating wave. We'd expect if the particle was coming from the left, that is from minus infinity, towards the potential, the incident wave you could think of in terms of this coefficient A, the reflected wave in terms of the coefficient B. As a result, in that region of space, there'll be both leftward and rightward propagating waves. And as a result, we will keep both terms in this region of space. The next region of space is over the well. Over the well, the potential is negative V0. And we actually considered this solution last time. In particular, the solution will be of the form psi equals C sine LX plus D cosine LX, where L is square root 2m E plus V0 over h bar. And so that should look very familiar from last lecture. The final region in space is x greater than a. And here, we know the potential is still zero. And as a result, we can write down directly that the form of the solution will be the same as here. But now we would think that in the right most portion of space, we'd only have the transmitted wave that is only a rightward propagating wave. And as a result, this will have the form F e I to the kx. That is only the transmitted waves considered. So when you get good at these problems, you can just write down the solutions. You don't even need to write down the Schrodinger equation anymore because we know what the solution will be. And for example, in the homework, when you consider the tunnel barrier, you should be able to just write down forms of the solution and go ahead and proceed with the heart of the problem, which is the application of the boundary conditions. Is everybody okay with these solutions? Okay. So all I have to do is apply boundary conditions. Of course, the boundary conditions include that the wave function itself is continuous at x equals minus a. So we'll go ahead and plug x equals minus a into this term and that, or this equation and that equation, set them equal to each other. As a result, a e to the minus I k a plus b e to the I k a is equal to negative c sine l a plus d cosine l a. Or we've exploited the fact that sine of minus lx is negative sine lx and cosine of minus lx is cosine of lx. We also know that the derivative d psi dx, because the potential is finite, will be continuous at x equals minus a. So we take the derivative of this function, the derivative of that function, plug in x equals minus a, and set them equal to one another. When we do that, we'll get a term or an equation of the following form, ik times a e to the minus ika minus b e to the ika equal to l times c cosine la plus d sine la. Okay. We have two more boundary conditions to apply. That is, psi continuous at x equals a and d psi dx continuous at x equals a. So we'll go ahead and do that. So at x equals a, we know that the form of the equation will now be c sine la plus d cosine la equal to f e to the I ka. So we plugged a into this equation and that equation, set them equal to each other. Finally, we'll take the derivative of psi and make sure that it is continuous at x equals a. Now give us one final equation, L times the quantity C cosine LA minus D sine LA is equal to IKF e to the IKA. And what we have now are five unknowns, A, B, C, D, and F, and four equations. But what matters, of course, is the probability of transmission or reflection, which will be given by F over A and B over A, respectively. And as a result, what we'll do is divide all these equations by A. And what that will leave us with are four unknowns. B over A, C over A, D over A, and F over A. We have four equations and four unknowns. Now we just have to solve that 4x4 series of equations. That just takes some algebra to do. I'm going to save you the details in class. You'll have an opportunity to do this when you solve the tunnel barrier problem. It'll be the same situation. The terms will be different, but it'll still be a 4x4 series of equations. So you can practice your algebra. The result is that the transmission coefficient to the minus 1 power has the following form. 1 plus V naught squared over 4e times e plus V naught times sine squared 2a over h bar square root 2m e plus V naught. You'll find that the solution for the tunnel barrier is similar, except you'll have hyperbolic sine functions as opposed to sine functions. That ultimately results from the fact that you're going to have exponentially decaying and growing functions in this region in space as opposed to sinusoidal and cosine functions. You'll see that in the homework. What we see here is that the transmission coefficient varies from 1 for most energies, and that, of course, is surprising again, because this particle has more energy than the well it's going over. And obviously, classically, we'd expect the transmission coefficient to always be 1. But it is not in this case. It deviates from 1. However, there are some magical values of energy where it is equal to 1. Whenever the sine function goes to 0, then the transmission coefficient does go to 1. So there are going to be these particular values of energy where it is as if there is no barrier or no scattering that occurs. That's something which is also unusual in quantum mechanics, but maybe not that unusual if we consider that quantum mechanically particles have wave-particle duality. And in classical electromagnetism, you'll find that there will be similar scattering barriers which will appear transparent at particular values of energy. The same thing will be true quantum mechanically. And that's actually a feature which can be utilized in many real-world devices. Devices such as resonant tunneling diodes will exploit the fact that there are particular values of energy where barriers no longer act as barriers, but are completely transparent. So we'll see that also in the homework. So just some final comments here. What we can see or note is that the transmission coefficient does go to 1. That is, the well is transparent whenever the sine function is 0. In other words, when the argument of the sine function, which we see is 2a over h bar square root 2m times e sub n plus v naught is equal to n pi, then of course the sine function will be 0. If we solve this for e sub n plus v naught, we see that we get out n squared pi squared h bar squared over 2m times the quantity 2a squared. Remember, the width of the well is 2a in this case because it's running from minus a to plus a, and as a result 2a represents the overall width. And so this series of energies, as it turns out, are exactly the same as those for the infinite square well. So there may be something deep here which you could think about. But when the energy of the particle going over the finite well potential is exactly equal to the energies of the infinite square well potential, there is no scattering. So you may want to think about that and try to rationalize why this is the case. So these are the energies. Of the infinite square well. If we were to plot this function, so if we were to plot the transmission coefficient as a function of energy, this of course runs between 0 and 1. There's somewhere between a 0 and 1 probability of transmission. We see that this function will have the form which looks something like this. The exact plot is in the book, figure 2.19, if you want to see it. But this is what we'd expect to see from the form of this function here. There are going to be these particular values of energy which correlate to the infinite square well, stationary state energies for which the potential goes to 1. And it's going to oscillate somewhere about that point in space. Okay, so it's unusual. I remember classically, you either have a 0 or 1 probability of transmitting across a barrier, whereas in quantum mechanics, we'll see that there will be cases where, as a function of energy, there will be oscillatory behavior in the transmission coefficient. And in particular, particular values of energy where the barrier is if it's not even present. And as I've alluded to many times, if we were to turn this problem on its head, instead of looking at a finite potential well, we look at a finite potential barrier. The rectangular barrier, which you'll consider in the homework, leads to an exponential dependence of the transmission probability on the thickness of the barrier. More precisely, the transmission coefficient will go as the hyperbolic sine function squared, but in the limit of large barrier thickness and or high barrier height, this will reduce to exponential dependence. And in most real-world situations, exponential dependence will be a suitable approximation. This notion of being able to go through a barrier is known as tunneling. You'll explore it in detail in the homework. Tunneling is, of course, one of the most important consequences of quantum mechanics, being utilized in devices such as the resonant tunneling diode, being utilized in the scanning tunneling microscope, enabling atomic resolution imaging of conductive substrates. It's a major problem in microelectronics, arguably the biggest problem facing the microelectronics industry, because now as gate oxide thicknesses decrease to the single nanometer length scale, tunneling becomes important, and as a result, there's significant leakage current in modern Pentium processors. This is driving up power consumption, temperature, and shortening battery lifetimes, all of which are problematic for the future of microelectronics. Strategies for either exploiting or overcoming tunneling is really the heart of electronic materials today. So I really want you to do this problem. It's going to be a little painful, I acknowledge, but it's so important that it's worth the pain to do it at least once in your life. And what better time than graduate school? Any final questions on 1D Schrodinger equation? Okay. So we're right on schedule. We're supposed to finish that this week. And so we have time actually to get ahead of schedule, which is worthwhile. Because the three-dimensional Schrodinger equation is more complicated. And it's probably good to have some extra time to discuss it over the next week. So when thinking about the 3D Schrodinger equation, really what we have to do is come up with some way of describing kinetic energy. The kinetic energy is the only term which is different between the 1D and 3D forms of the Schrodinger equation. Remember, in 1D, we just defined the kinetic energy in terms of the momentum operator, P. We said kinetic energy is P squared over 2m, like it is classically. We plugged in for P the momentum operator, which is the spatial derivative. So in three dimensions, you can imagine it'll still be P squared over 2m, but now we need a three-dimensional analog of a derivative. Three-dimensional analog of a derivative, we'll see in a minute, is the Laplacian. So let's talk about this problem. Schrodinger equation in three dimensions. And unfortunately, as material scientists, we have no choice but to consider this problem because essentially all materials are three-dimensional objects. So there's really no way to get around it. To be honest with you, even if you wanted to work with a single atom, you have no choice but to go to 3D, because even the hydrogen atom exists in three-dimensional space. So I'm sorry, but we have to do it. Okay, the Schrodinger equation, remember, generally is IH bar times partial of capital Psi with respect to time is equal to H capital Psi. The Hamiltonian is what we need to now consider. And the Hamiltonian we know is just the sum of kinetic energy, P squared over 2m, plus potential energy, V. And in Cartesian coordinates, this is easy to write down. The momentum squared in 3D is just the sum of the x, y, and z components squared of the momentum. Hopefully that's familiar from classical physics. So in Cartesian coordinates, we can reduce P squared into P sub x squared plus P sub y squared plus P sub z squared. And this is just a three-dimensional generalization of Pythagorean theorem from elementary school geometry. Okay, so this is how we would describe the momentum in three dimensions. Now what we want to do is describe this in terms of the momentum operators. What we're going to do is generalize the momentum operator into the three components. P sub x will become h bar over I, partial with respect to x, which is exactly what we had in one dimension. P sub y, similarly, will be h bar over I, partial with respect to y. And P sub z becomes h bar over I, partial with respect to z. And so if we were to try to write this down in some more general vector form, we could see that this refers to an x component, a y component, and a z component. And as a result, the condensed way in vector form to write down this series of three equations is to define a momentum vector, which of course it will be in three dimensions, and say that this is equal to h bar over I times the gradient. When the gradient operates on a function, we know that you take the x derivative and that becomes affiliated with the x component of the resulting gradient. The y derivative goes with the y component. Z derivative goes with the z component. The nice thing about the gradient is that you can define it in any coordinate system, whereas what we've done here is just in one coordinate system. We're going to find that in quantum mechanics, there'll be many potentials for which Cartesian coordinates are actually not very suitable. There'll be a very low degree of symmetry, and as a result, we're going to have to convert to other more suitable coordinate systems, such as spherical coordinates, and that's quite straightforward to do utilizing the gradient formulation of the momentum operator. Everybody okay with this? All right. If you're okay with this, then it's easy to write down. If you apply the gradient operator twice, what you get out is the Laplacian. And as a result, p squared becomes the Laplacian. And as a result, the Schrodinger equation becomes I h bar partial psi with respect to t is equal to negative h bar squared over 2m times the Laplacian of the wave function plus v times the wave function. As I've now said several times, del squared is the Laplacian. The Laplacian is defined in all coordinate systems and will utilize the appropriate Laplacian based upon the symmetry of the potential. In particular, the Laplacian in Cartesian coordinates del squared is just equal to the second partial with respect to x plus the second partial with respect to y plus the second partial with respect to z. And so it's relatively straightforward, the Laplacian. We'll see in spherical coordinates the Laplacian has many more terms and is much messier. But we'll find that it's worth going down that path because the application of the boundary conditions will be much easier. And the application of the boundary conditions is really the heart of all these problems, as hopefully you're beginning to see. Okay. Another thing that I'll point out, and this is a subtle point which many people have a difficult time appreciating at first, and that is when we add additional degrees of freedom, so as we go from 1D to 2D to 3D, what we're doing is increasing the kinetic energy. Right? Because now instead of just one term, we're going to have three terms contributing to the kinetic energy. What many people will attempt to do is say that as you go to greater dimensionality, you've delocalized the wave function, and by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you should decrease the uncertainty momentum, therefore decrease energy. But that argument is flawed because you're actually increasing the degrees of freedom and increasing the energy, kinetic energy of the system. For one particular coordinate system, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle still does apply. So if you confine your particle in one of those dimensions, the energy will go up. And we'll see that in the particular case of a particle in a box, which is the first potential we'll consider. Is everybody clear on that point? Increasing dimensionality increases energy, but within one particular dimension, decreasing or increasing localization increases energy. If you understand those two concepts, then you can qualitatively predict essentially any result in three-dimensional quantum mechanics. Okay. What else is different? Well, obviously we're in 3D now, so the potential energy and the wave function will be a function of three spatial coordinates. So the potential and the wave function are now functions. Instead of just x, they're functions of r, which is a vector defining some point in three-dimensional space. In Cartesian coordinates, this would be defined by three coordinates, x, y, and z. In spherical coordinates, would be defined by three coordinates, r, theta, and phi. And if you prefer some other coordinate system, there would be three other parameters which would define it uniquely. And of course, the wave function is still a function of t, so it's a four-dimensional problem that we're facing here. Other things from 1D quantum mechanics still hold. The probability of finding the particle in the infinitesimal volume dr vector, which in Cartesian coordinates is simply dx, dy, dz, but in spherical coordinates would be r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi. In another coordinate system, you'd have to determine what the infinitesimal volume element is. But the probability of finding the particle in that infinitesimal volume element dr is simply the magnitude squared of the three-dimensional wave function dr. Still is the same definition. The point, though, is that the differential volume element varies from coordinate system to coordinate system, so you have to keep track of the dependence of the differential volume element on your spatial coordinates in whatever coordinate system you've chosen to get the probability right. For example, If you're in spherical coordinates, recall that dr goes as r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi. So you have to multiply by another value of r squared to get out the probability. So somebody asks you in spherical coordinates where is the most likely probability or what is the most likely point in space to find the particle. You take the magnitude squared of psi times r squared and plot that as a function of r. Wherever you see a peak in that function is where you're most likely to find the particle. Question?
Is that the integral of that?
This is probably finding the particle in this infinitesimal volume. If you want to find it in some larger volume in space, then you would integrate over that volume. Absolutely. And as a result, the normalization condition is now clear. If we do a three-dimensional integral over all of space, using this as the integrand, it better equal 1. Yep. Okay. So yeah, you beat me to the punch. This implies that the normalization condition becomes an integral over all space, magnitude squared of psi dr equal to 1. Of course, you have to choose suitable bounds. If you're in Cartesian coordinates, you just integrate all three dimensions from minus infinity to infinity. But if you're in spherical coordinates, you'd integrate the r coordinate from 0 to infinity. You'd integrate the theta coordinate from 0 to pi and integrate the phi coordinate from 0 to 2 pi. If you do some other bounds, you're probably double counting. And that's, of course, a problem. Okay. So quantum mechanics sort of forces you to draw upon all of your previous mathematical training. And this is often an area where you haven't practiced lately unless you had a strong course in electromagnetism. So you may want to check out Schramm's outlines to review your 3D calculus if it's not fresh in your mind. In particular, we'll see the coordinate systems that matter to us will be Cartesian and spherical coordinates. And you'll see in a minute why spherical coordinates are so critical to all of chemistry and therefore all of material science. Okay. What else can we say generally about 3D Schrodinger equation? If the potential is independent of time, that is, the potential is only a function of r and not a function of time, then the solution to the Schrodinger equation via separation of variables, so you could do that same separation of variables we did in the first week of the course. In 3D, what it will result is that the solution will always have the form lowercase psi sub n, which is only a function of r, times e to the negative I e sub n t over h bar. These are, of course, stationary states. So they're going to be stationary states in 3D, just like in 1D. And the stationary states satisfy the 3D time-independent Schrodinger equation. So psi sub n of r satisfies the 3D time-independent Schrodinger equation, which has the following form, minus h-bar squared over 2m, the Laplacian operating on psi sub n plus v psi sub n equals e psi sub n. Fortunately, in this course, we'll only consider time-independent potentials. And as a result, you never have to go back to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. You can immediately deduce that the total wave function has this form, and all you have to determine are the stationary states, just like we did in 1D. Of course, once you have the stationary states, the general solution to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation will be capital Psi r comma t is equal to a sum over all the stationary state solutions with some coefficient for each of them, C sub n, times psi sub n e to the minus I e sub n t over h bar, where just like in 1D, the coefficients C sub n, are determined by the initial conditions, that is, capital Psi at time equals zero. So of course in the homework in 1D you're doing problems exactly like this. You do the same thing in 3D. The bottom line is that when you're given a potential, what you will first seek, assuming that the potential is time independent, are the stationary state energies, so I could put an E sub n here, and wave functions. Once you have those, you'll plug them into the general solution and utilize the initial conditions to determine what C sub n is. Once you have C sub n, you're done. You know exactly how the wave function will evolve as a function of time. Okay. So hopefully this looks like review because it's exactly what we did last week in 1D. Is everybody okay? So now all we're going to do is practice, try a few potentials just like we did in 1D. And in particular, I'll highlight that what we have is a multi-dimensional differential equation which we have to solve. And as a result, it will be useful in most cases to attempt to separate the variables in an attempt to solve this differential equation. So the 3D Schrödinger equation is typically solved using separation of variables. What you have to do as a scientist is decide which coordinate system is going to be easiest to separate the variables in. So if your potential has symmetry in Cartesian coordinates, you will likely choose Cartesian coordinates to separate the variables. If, on the other hand, your potential is spherically symmetric, it would make sense to choose spherical coordinates. So that's the first thing that you'd have to decide. So let's be less abstract and consider a specific example. And this is a very, very important example in solid-state physics. Particle in a box. The particle in a box solution will allow us to determine the density of states in a three-dimensional material. Also allows us to define the density of states in lower-dimensional materials as well, which we'll do in the second half of the course. So put this in your memory banks. What do I mean by particle in a box? What I'm saying is that the potential is equal to zero for x, y, or z between 0 and a, and infinity otherwise. That is, we have a cube with side of length a, where the particle can reside with zero potential energy, but it cannot escape that box. So it's confined in space. It's like the infinite potential well generalized to 3D with Cartesian symmetry. We'll also do the spherical version of this problem, probably not today, but next time. Okay. So, one thing we could say immediately, and I'm not even going to bother writing it down because it should be obvious to us now, is that the wave function is zero outside of the box. There's no probability of finding it there. All I have to do is determine what the wave function is inside the box and apply boundary conditions. So we'll jump straight to inside the box. The Schrödinger equation is minus h bar squared over 2m times the Laplacian of the wave function is just equal to E psi, since the potential is zero inside the box. There's no potential energy term. The kinetic energy is equal to the total energy. What we'll now attempt to do is try separation of variables in the coordinate system where we have the highest degree of symmetry of the potential, and that's obviously Cartesian coordinates. So we'll try separation of variables in Cartesian coordinates, which will imply that we're going to assume the wave function is the following form. It's going to be the product of three functions, one function capital X, which is only a function of X, a second function capital Y, which is only a function of Y, and a third function capital Z, which is only a function of the Z coordinates. And if you recall how this works, what we do is we plug in this new wave function into the Schrödinger equation, and we attempt to separate the variables. And if you look at the Schrödinger equation, if you recall, the Laplacian in 3D is the sum of three second partial derivatives in each of the three coordinate systems. And so you can see that the wave function operating, the second partial x operating on the wave function will only operate on x, and y and z will carry through. Similarly, the second term will only operate on capital Y, and the third term in Laplace will only operate on capital Z. At that point, if we divide both sides of the equation by psi, we should have successfully separated the variables. That's exactly what we did in 1D. Okay. So if you didn't follow that, let's write it down. Minus h bar squared over 2m. In Cartesian coordinates, the Laplacian is the sum of the spatial derivatives in each of the three coordinates. This will operate on the wave function, which we're now attempting to separate. And we've defined it as capital X, capital Y, capital Z. This will be equal to the energy multiplied by the wave function, which is capital X, capital Y, capital Z. As I said before, this term in the Laplacian only operates on X since Y and Z are independent of X, so that Y and Z will come out in front. So the first term becomes minus H bar squared over 2M, capital Y, capital Z, second partial of capital X with respect to X. The second term is minus H bar squared over 2M. This will only operate on Y, so X and Z come out in front of the second derivative, times the second partial of capital Y with respect to lowercase y. The third term obviously will only operate on z, so x and y come out in front. Second partial of capital Z with respect to lowercase z. And this is equal to e times xyz. What we then do is divide both sides of this equation by capital X, capital Y, capital Z. We can see that the y and z will cancel, and we just get 1 over x for the first term. So the first term is minus h bar squared over 2m, 1 over capital X, second partial capital X with respect to lowercase x. The second term, similarly, will now only be a function of capital Y times the second partial of capital Y with respect to y squared. The final term is now only a function of capital Z, 1 over capital Z, times second partial of capital Z with respect to Z. And the right-hand side is just a constant. So the first term is only a function of X. Second term is only a function of Y. The third term is only a function of Z. And as a result, the only way for the sum of these three terms to always equal a constant E, they each have to be a constant. And so we'll say that this term here is equal to E sub X. This term here is equal to E sub Z, or E sub Y, and the third term is equal to E sub Z, such that the total energy E is the sum of these three terms. So we successfully separated the variables. We took a three-dimensional differential equation and turned it into three one-dimensional differential equations. Even better, each of these three differential equations is exactly the same. Even better, each of these three differential equations is identical to the particle in the one-dimensional infinite potential well, which we already solved. So we can immediately write down the solution to each of these three differential equations, simply multiply them together to get the total wave function, and sum together the stationary state energies to get the total energy. So this is why we bothered with the infinite potential well, because we're going to utilize that result here. Okay. So to reiterate that point, we can see that we've reduced this into three differential equations, which have the form negative h bar squared over 2m, second partial of capital X with respect to x squared, is equal to e sub x times capital X. And this is just the 1D infinite potential well. We already know the solution, we just write it down. Capital X, which we now know is quantized and will have an index n sub x, is equal to square root 2 over a sine of n sub x pi x over a. Furthermore, e sub x, we now know is quantized with an index n sub x, which is equal to n sub x squared pi squared h bar squared over 2m a squared. Since the y and z differential equations are identical, we're done. We can now write down immediately that the total wave function in 3D will now have three quantum numbers affiliated with it, n sub x, n sub y, n sub z, is equal to this term times the analogous term in the y dimension times the analogous term in the z dimension. So we're going to get three terms of square root 2 over a, which of course is just 2 over a to the 3 halves, times sine n sub x pi x over a, sine n sub y pi y over a, times sine n sub z pi z over a. Furthermore, we know the stationary state energies will be labeled with three quantum numbers, n, x, n, y, and z, and will be equal to n sub x squared plus n sub y squared plus n sub z squared times a constant E1, where E1 is just going to be pi squared h bar squared over 2ma squared. This is, of course, the ground state energy of the infinite potential well in 1D. What you'll immediately see, and I should remind you, is that n sub x, n sub y, n sub z are the natural numbers, that is 1, 2, 3, etc. And so the ground state energy of a particle in a box will be 1 squared plus 1 squared plus 1 squared, which is 3 times E sub 1. And so the minimum energy in the 3D particle in a box problem is greater than the minimum energy in 1D. And again, this is the common misconception that as you go to 3D, the particle should have more space and its energy should drop. But that's not the case. The kinetic energy gets two additional terms due to the two new degrees of freedom, and so the energy goes up. However, if you were to try to confine one of the dimensions, any one of the dimensions, then A would decrease and the energy would go up. So Heisenberg uncertainty principle still does apply in each of the individual dimensions. Okay? Yeah?
Just wondering, when you came up with the solution for x, I mean, I see how it's completely analogous to the 1D system, but do you have to worry about the coefficient at all, like, in terms of normalization?
Right. Normally you would. But in this case, if you recall, when you do a three-dimensional integral in Cartesian coordinates, you're just integrating the differential element just dx, dy, dz, and you're integrating each of those coordinates from minus infinity to infinity. So you can reduce that three-dimensional integral into the product of three one-dimensional integrals, which are all identical to the normalization condition in 1D. But normally, you would say this is some new normalization constant, b or whatever, you want to define it, and you would do the 3D integral to determine it. And so when we do the hydrogen atom, for example, yeah, we're going to have to be more careful about the normalization condition. It's just the symmetry here that allows us to do this. That's a good question. Any other questions? Okay. So let me just make a couple more comments on this, and then we'll move on to spherically symmetric potentials. I've already made one comment, and that is we can see the ground state energy will be 3 times E1. What's more interesting is when we go to the first excited state energy, in that case, either n sub x will equal to, or n sub y will equal to, or n sub z will equal to, with the other two quantum numbers equal to 1. So we'll get 1 squared plus 1 squared plus 2 squared, which is just 6 times E1. What's interesting is that there's three unique series of quantum numbers which give us the same first excited state energy. So that implies that there is degeneracy. There will be distinct quantum states with the exact same energy. So we'll see in this case that there's threefold degeneracy in the first excited state. That's something which does not occur in 1D, but degeneracy is something which will be very common in 3D and will lead to some complications later on. So to summarize, the ground state a particle in a box is clearly E11 is equal to 3E1, and there's only one possible quantum state that satisfies the ground state energy. But now there are going to be three equivalent energetically excited first excited states. That is E211 is equal to E121, which is equal to E112, which is obviously equal to 6 E1. And what I'm asking you to note is the threefold degeneracy. So a common exam problem will give you some potential. You'll solve the stationary state energies. Then I'll ask you, what is the fourth excited state and what is the degeneracy of the fourth excited state? So you have to think about what possible permutations of your quantum numbers give you the same energy. Okay. Any questions on particle in a box? As I said, you'll want to recall it. One thing that I'll point out about particle in a box is that as A becomes large, as you'd have in a macroscopic piece of material, say 1 centimeter, then the spacing between the energy levels becomes very small because A is in the denominator of the stationary state energy. And as a result, it will be common in 3D to define the energy as a continuous variable, even though we know that it's really quantized. And so to deal with that apparent contradiction, we'll define a so-called density of states, which will tell us how many states there are between two particular values of energy. And once we've done that, we'll be able to reduce a problem which would be quantized into a continuous variable. So we'll come back to this problem at that time. Okay. But as I've alluded to, there are very few problems which are actually solvable in Cartesian coordinates. There are many potentials which are a function only of the distance between two particles. For example, if you have two charged particles, the energy between them is just a function of the distance, 1 over r, the Coulomb potential. So the question is, how do we deal with a potential which is only a function of the magnitude of the vector r? And that is most easily handled in spherical coordinates. So what we're going to do for the next few days is consider spherically symmetric potentials. First in general, and then specifically the Coulomb potential. By this I mean that V is only a function of the magnitude of R, where from now on when I just write R without the vector, I mean the magnitude of the vector R. So I'm not going to write down the magnitude of R over and over again. I'll just write it as lowercase r without the vector present. Okay. This is spherically symmetric, and so it suggests that spherical coordinates will be useful. In case spherical coordinates are not fresh in your mind, let me remind you of what they are in terms of the Cartesian coordinates. So if we have a three-dimensional Cartesian coordinate system defined by x, y, and z, and some arbitrary vector r, spherical coordinates are defined in terms of three parameters: the magnitude of r, which is the length of this vector, the angle between the vector and the z-axis, which is theta, and finally, if we were to project this vector into the xy plane, so that's a right angle there, the angle between the projection into the xy plane and the x-axis is phi. So you can uniquely define any point in space with these three parameters, r, theta, and phi. And as a result, if you apply trigonometry, you can now define x in terms of these three parameters. X is r sine theta cosine phi. Y is r sine theta sine phi. And z is r cosine theta. Furthermore, we could apply the three-dimensional Pythagorean theorem to relate r squared to x squared, y squared, and z squared. In particular, r squared is x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And perhaps most importantly, the differential volume element in spherical coordinates, dr, is r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi, where r will go between 0 and infinity. Theta will go between 0 and pi, and phi will go between 0 and 2 pi. That will uniquely define all space. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the Laplacian in spherical coordinates has the following form. So take a deep breath. 1 over r squared, partial with respect to r, times the quantity r squared, partial with respect to r, plus 1 over r squared sine theta, partial with respect to theta, times the quantity, or operating on the quantity, sine theta, partial with respect to theta, plus 1 over r squared sine squared theta second partial with respect to phi. Any problem which is spherically symmetric in quantum mechanics has to deal with this Laplacian. You can see that there are 5 terms, because when you take the partial on the product of 2, you're going to have to apply the product rule, so you'll get 2 terms here. Similarly here, you're going to have to apply the partial derivative on 2 terms, so you're going to get 2 more terms here, and then a 5th term. Okay. So dealing with this equation is what we're up against. The good news is that the angular components, theta and phi, we only have to solve once, because it will always be the same. We're going to employ separation of variables to separate out the r dependence, and the potential is only a function of r. So the theta and phi dependence will always be the same. Just like when we did stationary state solutions or time-independent Schrodinger equation, we're going to solve the time differential equation once, which we did in the first or second day of class. We never solved it again. We supply the result. Same will be true for the theta and phi problems. So we're going to reduce this problem, although it looks messy now, into a simple one-dimensional Schrodinger equation. And we're going to see that one-dimensional Schrodinger equation looks very similar to the Schrodinger equation in one dimension, except for one additional term. And that one additional term will actually have some deep physical meaning, which we'll see, not today, of course, but on Monday. So I'll leave you with that. You can mull over spherical coordinates over the weekend. And next time we'll do the angular equation, which we'll only do once, and then we'll consider the radial equation, which is all we will need then to solve the hydrogen atom. All right, thanks.
MSE 405.